Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, we got to get people back to work. The subsidies are over, right? There's no longer any free money in staying home. Why aren't people going back to work?
Here's the thing. We don't really know. I have to be honest with you. There are so many different reasons why these people are not going back to work, and we don't have the answers just yet. That's very confounding. You know, I do feel like when we talk about some of these issues around the labor market, we get stuck in the granular data without really talking about some of the big picture. So can I do big picture first,
yes,
and then I'll
please.
Tell you what's wrong with the data?
Yes.
So big picture, we're doing really well. We really are. I mean, there is no doubt that after losing 22 million jobs at the in the spring of the COVID heat, right, that April, March, April, May period in 2020, we've recouped 84% of those jobs. It's amazing in a short period of time. And what we also know is that that wages are rising, jobs are plentiful, and you know, in general, if you want a job, this is not for every single person, but for most people who really want a job, there's a job to be had. The problem with the COVID era is that the nature of a pandemic means that there are other issues that have never cropped up in the labor market ever in the history of how we've kept these numbers and keeping the data points in mind. So I think that when you look at some of the particulars, like we get a jobs report that came out on Friday, and it shows that if you ask a business, how many jobs did you fill last month? They say 199,000. If you talk to households, they say, how many of you got a job in December? 650. 51,000. Something's going on in this data that is showing a huge gap like that. And so when you read that, oh, there was a big miss on the jobs report, I don't think that really articulates what the condition of the labor market is right now.
So in other words, the data is corrupted somewhere and we don't know why.
Yeah, I wouldn't say corrupted. I would say that there could be some lagging issues. In other words, maybe someone in a household has quit their job and is taken off, you know, November, December, and January, and said, I'll start looking in February. Mm-hmm. And then the virus, or says, you know, I'm quitting in December, and then maybe you have this variant that crops up and said, you know, I'm not going to look so fast. So there are some lags in data. People, we know that 4.5 million people quit their jobs, the highest number on record, by the way. And some of those people are clearly going to take other jobs. We just don't know that they've taken them yet, or whether they're taking their time knowing that the job market is a good one. We also don't know how many people are really turning those side hustles or gigs into their main source of income. We don't know how many people are maybe improperly identifying where they are. They could have been told to go home and take off 2 weeks, and that could mean for them they're not working, but really they're employed. So there are a lot of problems in the way that the numbers are being reported, not so much as it like corrupting, it's just that there are unique circumstances associated with this period of time that we've never encountered previously.
Just so there seems to be so many unhappy, stressed out people, and I assumed it was because of the job market, but so really we don't know what the malaise is all about.
Well, I mean, look, I think the malaise is certainly about a number of things. One is that people are tired after almost 2 years of this. You know, we're entering our third year of uncertainty. And, you know, it's funny, when I was doing research for my book, I interviewed a psychologist at length, by the way, about what uncertainty does to your brain. And how it makes you really, it's almost worse to feel uncertain than it is to be sure of about bad outcome. And so I was talking about that when it comes to investments, because I think that when people feel uncertainty in their financial lives or with their investments, it drives them crazy. If you know you're in a bear market, you can kind of like deal with it. And if you know you've lost your job, you can deal with it. If you know that there is so many different moving pieces in your life and you don't know how to manage those pieces, that creates uncertainty. And that creates discontent. And I think that's part of the issue that's cropping up right now. I don't have my daycare nailed down. My kid is not vaccinated. My parents are older and I'm worried about them. I'm an older worker and I don't want to go back just yet. Can I really afford to retire? I think the most frequently asked question on my podcast right now is, when do I have the option of doing something different? It's not just I want to quit. It's I want to do something different with the rest of my work life. What I was doing before COVID truly was not something that was sustainable. And now I found out what is important.
So what would help here? What would give people certainty? Does it have to come from Washington? I mean, that's all we're getting from Washington right now is uncertainty, whether democracy is even going to be here 4 years from now.
I think that what has to happen is not necessarily a policy issue. In certain cases, it might be. In that, if you had a policy where childcare was much more affordable for people who are middle income and lower, I think that that would remove a great deal of uncertainty. But it wouldn't remove the uncertainty of this condition called the virus. It would not remove COVID uncertainty. And, you know, you have to really look back to understand why this is so strange in some respects. If you look at confidence indicators from the spring of 2020, when we were really freaking out, okay, gang, like, don't forget, like, it was super scary. People were dying. Cities emptied out. It was a strange time. And yet, the confidence indicators at that time were not actually plummeting to their all-time lows. They are plummeting to all-time lows now. Why? Because of inflation, because we're tired, because we have uncertainty. And that, to me, just sort of shows you the human condition. Sometimes when you're in the heat of the battle, you can sort of manage it. You put one foot in front of the other. You don't have a lot of choices. Then all of a sudden you emerge and it's still murky. It's scary. You know, I have a friend of mine who's a doctor, and she often will say to me, the worst time to be a doctor is the period between when you think you've found something and you have the confirmation that it's really bad.
Yes.
I said, you mean like telling someone they might have cancer is terrible, but once you tell them they have cancer and you have a treatment plan, they can deal with it. And I think that that's the issue right now. We don't really have a treatment plan right now.
We all need a really good counselor is what it sounds like.
I mean, just call my show.
Yeah, I know. CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. In the 2 years we've been obsessed with COVID, another major medical problem has gotten a lot worse. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And Dr. Cohen, the problem is obesity. There's a new study showing that we have more overweight young adults than we've ever seen before. What's going on?
It's been well known over the past four decades that there's been an increase in the average body mass index for young adults. But in the most recent study, it showed that there was about a 6% increase in the 18 to 25 age group, up to almost one third or 33% of people in that age group. That's significant because if you're starting your adult life already with what amounts to obesity, that has significant implications for really the rest of your life.
Okay, so we're in the middle of this this campaign to stamp out COVID. The government has taken a pretty strong role in developing and rolling out vaccines and, you know, demanding testing and all the rest. Is obesity any of the government's business? Is this something that ought to be the subject of some sort of concerted campaign to get it under control? Because my understanding is, I think you've told me this, that one of the reasons we have such high COVID death rates in America is because if you're obese, it magnifies the damage that COVID does.
Right. I actually think that's an excellent question. You know, what is the government's business and what isn't? I think the government has a responsibility to educate the public, not to mandate what people do, but to educate them so that they can make good choices. And, you know, we have never in the history of the country and even in medicine done an adequate job of doing that. And so it's not surprising that this problem is growing and getting worse and worse and worse. And it's affecting this young group of people now who are going to be afflicted with this for, you know, decades to come.
You think there would be a niche for a chain of grocery stores called the "This Food Won't Kill You" grocery store, where the only foods that it sells are foods that are free of damaging amounts of carbohydrates and all of it, free of processed food, et cetera, such that if you just shopped there, you wouldn't die before your time.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's what, you know, Whole Foods started out as. But the reality is that, you know, stores like that, they are just, you know, delivering what the consumers demand, but they're not actually doing the education. If we look at people who live at the blue zones in the world, these are the areas where people live very long periods of life. They don't consume much red meat. Mm-hmm. They do eat seafood. They eat lots of olive oil, almost in unrestricted quantities. They eat a lot of foods that are rich in antioxidants, including drinking red wine. But they also get a lot more activity than we do. So if we try to extrapolate that information, and you hear, you know, people talking about eating the Mediterranean diet, well, the problem is that there's really not fantastic information. I'm sure I'm going to get stones thrown at me for this one, but there really isn't fantastic information on exactly how to make the Mediterranean diet part of your daily existence. And it really has to be a comprehensive approach, not only about how you eat, but still how much you eat, when you eat, and the amount of activity that you get. But again, there's still this complex interplay of genetic factors, environmental factors, even the, you know, things we can't control that we're exposed to on a daily basis. So I think it remains a complex issue, but clearly we're headed in the wrong direction. And I think a lot of it right now, when we look at this really very large number of people who were studied, to see this in this young group, it is a reflection of, I think, poor food choices and lack of activity as we spend more time watching TV, and that includes playing video games. I mean, I think those things are contributors. They're just not the whole story.
Okay, then how about this idea? Suppose the government declared that there had, in every store, in every grocery store, there had to be at least one aisle, which we would call the blue zone aisle, and the sign would say, if you confine your shopping to this aisle and this aisle only, you will only bring into your home foods that will not kill you. And as a bonus, we will pick up 50% of the cost of the food you buy on this aisle, just to keep America healthy. How about that?
It's not a bad idea. I think it exists. It's, you know, the fresh vegetable section.
It's called the produce section.
If you put the olive oil in there and the red wine in there, you'd pretty much have it. I guess you need nuts and seeds as well. But if you put all those together, but I think it already sort of exists. You know, if you walk into some of these healthier grocery stores, you know, they have that stuff all together.
All right. Well, I guess you make your choices and take your consequences.
That's it.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, there will be changes coming to the King County Prosecutor's Office, because after 15 years as County Prosecutor, Dan Satterberg has decided to move on. And Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott is here with more on his decision not to seek re-election and who would like to succeed him. So was this just a decision to do something different, or was there a political reason that he didn't want to face voters again, Hannah?
Well, none that he shared with me. It sounded like it's just time. You know, he's been the King County Prosecutor for 15 years. He's been in the office for 37 years, I believe it is.
He was Norm Mailing's assistant, right?
Right, exactly. And then when Norm died unexpectedly, he was appointed by the Republicans at the time committee, and then, you know, won re-election ever since. So he just felt it was time. I did try to press him on what might come next, and here's what he had to say.
You know, when I am finished being the prosecuting attorney, there's a lot of other things that I am interested in. And for me, foundational justice issues like hunger and housing and health, those are how we define whether we truly have social justice in King County. So I'll always be interested in helping to reduce the suffering and increase the peace and the justice up there. And I'll look for ways to do that. But, you know, I've been here a long time. I've seen a lot of changes. I've made some of those changes myself. I'm confident that I'm leaving this a better office than when I arrived in 1985. And different. And, you know, it's time for me to move on. I'm very excited about what lies ahead, but I'm also very serious about the next year. We have a lot of work to do here.
And they do have a lot of work to do. And he's, as he said there, was going to be very focused on the next 350 some odd days.
We have around 250 murder cases that are set for trial. Those have to get in front of a jury. in an expeditious fashion. We do have the first police officer charged with murder in the state. That trial is ours to complete as well. And we're also launching some really exciting new diversion programs that involve community partners. So
he shared some details about one of those programs with me.
We have around 250 murder cases.
Hold on for me. And this is they already have so many diversion programs. This one's a little different.
We'll have one that starts soon for adults who are facing their first felony charge for a nonviolent crime. And we will, instead of putting them through the whole process where today they're going to have to wait a long time to get to a courtroom, it's just because of our backlog. It makes a lot more sense instead to quickly send them into a community nonprofit organization that's paid to define accountability, to hold that person accountable, but also to help the person who was harmed and to make sure that the person who caused the harm doesn't do it again.
So they also have, the reason that they're focusing on that first felony is because his experience shows him that after that first felony, the second felony, third felony, fourth felony, they really start to add up quickly. So that's the reason for focusing on that. And I also got a chance to ask him what he was most proud of during his time as prosecutor. He had a few different thoughts, but here's one thing he shared.
I have had a long and lucky career here. And at the age of 30, I was appointed chief of staff by Norm Mailing, who was the prosecuting attorney. And I got to work with Norm for 17 years until he died. And so he taught me a lot about how the prosecutor can use power. And we have tremendous discretion about when to use that power, when not to. And it's part of what's allowed us to do some things like the LEAD program, like to decide we're not going to put somebody in court if we can instead hook them up with a case manager and a place to live and a path toward recovery. So I think a new approach to drug crimes for sure.
He also was very proud of the fact that he was willing to share both his ideas and the work and the problems with the community and those in his office and give folks in his office a chance to shine as well. And I've seen that, you know, with their domestic violence visions, of course, the ERPO division, all those folks where he really takes a step back and let them be in the spotlight and make, handle all of those types of issues and really make a difference in the county. And shortly after, so he announced this at 11:30 on Friday, and then within an hour, we got word from his chief of staff that she was going to run. Her name is Lisa Mannion. She's been a 27-year veteran.
I have worked for the prosecuting attorney's office for over 20 years, and I care about the people that work within the office. I care about criminal justice. I care about our civil legal work, and I am really proud of the work that I have done in the office. I'm really proud of our national reputation. I know that we still have work to do, and I don't want the momentum to stop, and I don't want the work to stop. So I'm running out of my deep love and care for the office.
But she did, well, she agrees with much of Dan Satterberg's policies. She says there's a couple of things where areas where she differs. One of them is...
One area of focus that is different for me than from Dan is the fact that I am very much aware of the gender differences between men and women. And I mean that in this way. I think how we provide services to victims, it matters how we reach women and how we serve women. I think when it comes to building strong leaders and promoting strong leaders within the office, it matters how we encourage and coach and mentor women.
And she says that same difference applies when we're talking about the criminal justice system.
When I think about men versus women coming out of our criminal justice system, I think women reentering our society need different things and should be treated differently than men. And I think I bring that focus to our work. I think I bring that awareness to the work. And I also think that I can help generate awareness in our community.
The other area where she differs is when it comes to handling cases of kids who were charged as adults.
I'm very proud of the fact that the prosecuting attorney's office uses that option very rarely. But when it happens, I do think those cases should be handled by our juvenile division and not handled by an adult prosecution unit. Our juvenile division is staffed with very experienced attorneys who are very knowledgeable about the juvenile justice laws. They're caught up on the adolescent brain science. and they are perfectly capable of handling those cases.
So that is the first person who came out to announce. And also on Friday, two other people had filed with the PDC, Public Disclosure Commission. King County Councilmember Rod Dombowski has now filed as of Friday to run for King County Prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And then also Jim Farrell. Now, this is the Federal Way Mayor, Jim Farrell, who has, I believe, 8 years as in a prosecuting office, a deputy prosecuting attorney in his own realm before he was mayor. He's also a little different tone than most of what I've heard so far and what I know from Rod Dombowski, in that he is very concerned about the public safety issues in King County. So
I think there's a perception among conservatives that Dan Satterberg spent a little too much time trying out things like restorative justice and reconciliation rather than taking bad people and locking them up.
There is certainly among some conservatives, but I think not to the extent that you saw perhaps that opinion when it with City Attorney Pete Holmes or former City Attorney Pete Holmes. I don't think it's quite as sharp, but it certainly, yeah, there definitely is that opinion. And, you know, you remember that Dan Satterberg was originally a Republican. He then got the voters to approve and make that office nonpartisan, then later came out and said that his views align more with Democratic views, and that preceded his push to end the death penalty in the state. So he's definitely gone the other direction. I think you'd see the starkest difference with Jim Farrell, Federal Way Mayor, who's been very boisterous about with the South Sound mayors who have been meeting and talking about all of the violence in their areas. So you'd see that kind of a thing. But a long time before deadline, so I think you'll see this race fill up as well.
Current News Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. CBS's Steve Hartman is looking for hope in the new year. It's been a rough start, hasn't it? So he reached out, unique, to a tarot card reader to look into America's future.
To some, 2022 has already dropped the ball. We've already stewed in the resurrection of our insurrection. We've seen people stuck in traffic for hours and in airports for days. We've seen a spike in COVID cases, triggering a nationwide epidemic of deja vu. So how will we manage?
Going into the future,
Winslow had answers.
A higher octave of where we are now.
Unfortunately, they went way over my crown chakra.
It's going inward time.
Does anything here say we're going to be okay?
That's not good.
But there was one card to go, and I'll show you that in a minute. But first, a look at the wild card in this query. That resilient group of Americans who dictate their own future, always taking whatever lousy hand they're dealt and somehow finding aces.
Please maintain control.
Whether it's the woman who turned her airport delay into a ukulele recital.
Airport's a good place to practice.
Or the strangers who broke bread from a bakery truck on I-95.
Just trying to help out.
We saw smiles pop up in the most unlikely places this week.
Did the outpouring surprise you?
Yeah. Yes.
Heidi and Steve Boatwright lost everything in the Colorado fire.
Here we have the Boatwrights.
But have since been flooded with goodwill and great comfort.
People sending care packages, donating, names we don't know. We're trying to Google some of these names. Like, who is this? I don't know who this is.
It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
I hear stories of kindness like that and wonder, is our future fated or is it divined from the way we treat one another? That's what I believe. And Winslow,
what's the last one?
Or someone out there.
Aw.
Agrees.
It's a card of choosing love.
Steve Hartman, CBS News, on the road.
I'm glad the good card finally came up in the deck.
Yeah.
7:48, and now from the G and Ursula show, which starts at 9 right here on Cairo Radio, here is G Scott, and of course the teams waste no time in firing non-productive coaches. How many coaches were fired yesterday?
Well, I think it was one yesterday, and I think so far, I think Nagy was fired today, and Zimmer was fired today.
Which teams are those?
Minnesota Vikings and the Chicago Bears head coach was fired today. Mm-hmm. And then a shocker that I'm still, like, I really, you know, usually there's times that I'm like, well, you know, I can see why that coach is, well, maybe I don't agree, maybe I disagree, you know, But Brian Flores, the head coach for the Miami Dolphins, was fired today. And I'm telling you right now, this is creating shockwaves. Head coach for the Miami Dolphins finished the last 9 games of the season 8-1. They won 8 out of the last 9 games, including beating the Patriots. The last game of the season, the only team they lost to were the Kansas City Chiefs in those last 9 games, and they fired the head coach. And I'm hearing people are saying that it is a possibility that they fired that head coach because they want to bring in the ex-coach for the 49ers, Jim Harbaugh. I was a little upset with that. But, hey, so far, so good. The most important thing is Pete Carroll so far still has his job with the Seattle Seahawks. And, again, it's only 7:49 here on the West Coast. So I just want to be clear about that.
You go minute by minute?
I don't think.
But I've been telling you guys for 2 months that Pete Carroll is going to keep his job. And it's more like what people don't understand is with coaching, it is more than X's and O's. Pete Carroll is more than X's and O's, right? What he has done over the last 10 years since he's been here, he's been here 12, but since he has been here, he has just done nothing but amazing things, including raising the expectations of Seahawks football. And so when you start
the whole culture,
the entire culture, Colleen, absolutely.
And he's buddies with John Schneider. Like, I see those two. They're really close. I don't know. Maybe that doesn't matter in the business world of the NFL. But I just feel like John has somebody he really trusts in Pete.
I mean, it doesn't matter what world it is. I mean, friends can only go so far. You got to get some production. You know what I mean?
You think that he could be on the chopping block from John Schneider?
No, I don't I don't think that because Pete Carroll has done an excellent job. I'm just trying to just say that friendships don't really save you from business decisions. But when you say, and then I want to take it another step further. Like, I know that the conversations or discussions have been centered around what's going to happen. Like, is Pete going to be here? Is Russell going to be here? Was this last game in Arizona? Is that the last time that we see Russell and Pete together? And I've been saying it then and I'll say it again now. No, Russell Wilson has a no trade clause in his contract. Russell Wilson is a future Hall of Fame quarterback. And for anybody that thinks that it is a good idea to get rid of number 3, Russell Wilson, then who would you replace him with? What quarterback out there? And that's the thing. Whenever you look on social media, everybody sometimes, if they had this idea like, yeah, you should get rid of Russell, for who? Who would be the quarterback that you'd bring in and say, yeah, you know what? This quarterback right here would be so much better.
Yeah, but somewhere out there, there's the way,
well, people always want changes sometimes. Sometimes you just need a little therapy, a little counseling. I've been telling you guys.
You think the current team, as it's built, just needs therapy? I think that they still haven't built the right team around Russell.
Yes, not many crazy changes. This team has lost this season. They lost 5 games of 3 points or less. Back in the day, these were games that they used to win. They're not too far off from being a championship caliber type of team. Do they need to make some fixes? Sure. Does it need to be this whole get rid of this coach, get rid of all? No, they are not that far away. They played in the NFC West division, an NFC West division out of 4 teams. 3 of those teams are in the playoffs. Now, that hurts to say that, but I'm just trying to give an understanding of just how tough the division was this year. And of those teams, they beat the Arizona Cardinals yesterday. They beat the San Francisco 49ers twice.
Yep.
And I think they lost to the Rams twice by 10 points or less. Oh, and by the way, our starting quarterback hurt his finger and had to get finger surgery on the hand that he throws at.
By the way, speaking of injuries, I have to ask what's prognosis Diggs. For Quandre Diggs?
Yeah, it was rough. He broken fibula and a dislocated ankle. I just want to just say this. He is an amazing young man. He's an amazing man. He's done nothing but be great with the Seattle Seahawks. And it's just something about down there. I can't stand it down in Arizona. That stadium took out Earl Thomas, took out Richard Sherman, took out Cam Chancellor. Like, think about that. Those were their last games as Seahawks in that stadium. Huh. So I'm hoping that this doesn't take out Quandre Diggs.
I mean, I saw that one of the guys got up with a divot of grass in his helmet.
I don't even know what it is. I just know it's some type of something. Earl Thomas' last game was in Arizona. Richard Sherman's last game as a Seahawks was in Arizona. Cam Chancellor's last game as a Seahawks was in Arizona. I don't know.
All right. Well, let's just not go back down there again.
I guess no. What I would say. Have a good morning, guys.
All right. Thank you. G. Scott with Ursula starting at 9 here on Cairo Radio. Seattle's Morning News. Good to have you tuned in Monday morning. The 2022 legislative session officially convenes today. And Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott has more on the lawmakers' priorities and what's on tap for the first week of what is scheduled to be only a 60-day session. Hannah.
Yes, that's right, Dave. Well, the session will officially start at noon today. And there are a couple of big priorities that have been getting a lot of headlines. We'll start, of course, with the police bills, the police legislation that was passed last year that has come to be a problem with in some areas, some departments not responding to certain calls because of their confusion over these bills. And you've heard from some of the Democratic sponsors who got these bills through that, yes, perhaps there were some gaps or some ambiguities that need fixing. So everyone on both sides of the aisle seems to agree that there needs to be fixes and that they need to come quickly. House Speaker Lori Jenkins says one of those fixes will involve the clarification that, yes, you can still use a certain caliber of weapon when it comes to less lethal force, like the beanbag rounds. That was something that kind of fell through the cracks from all sides when one of the bills passed that made it so it read to the make it sound like you could no longer use those and really leaving only the most deadly force as an option. So that'll be a top priority to fix. A couple of others, she says.
Second addresses the mental health issues, making sure that law enforcement officers can use force subject to the reasonable care standard when it comes to welfare checks, mental health issues, child welfare, things like that. And then the third issue has to do with the threshold of whether or not you can use force, whether or not you have to have probable cause or reasonable cause. And so Roger Goodman has a bill saying that probable cause standard that was set in bills last year will go back down to reasonable cause for violent offenses, sex offenses, assaults, and things like that.
And so this sounds like an admission they really screwed up last year.
You hear a lot of from the Democrats, and in fact, I think Lori Jenkins said it in this session as well, that this is normal for the legislature, that you see a lot of what legislators spend their time doing is fixing bills from prior sessions, mm-hmm. fixing, you know,
but as you explained to us last week, the problem last year was that they just didn't hold enough hearings with people who knew what they were talking about.
Well, and again, that's not entirely true. There were people who came and said their piece. They just mm-hmm. didn't get incorporated into the bills, right? So you had the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs who were very regular in attendance, do all things on public safety. And they said, look, this is going to be an issue. This is going to be an issue. This is going to be an issue. They came out, in fact, with their own draft of what they thought the police reform bills should be. And they're very much always in support of reform. Just mm-hmm. do it in a way that's right. going to not have, you know, negative
outcomes.
Well,
what I'm getting at is, I know it's a short session, but will they listen this time? Because I'm sure there are plenty of other bills that could benefit from expert testimony.
This is a top priority for both sides. So as you mm-hmm. hear House Speaker Lori Jenkins saying right there that those bills will get support. Again, who you've got behind some of these bills is Representative Johnson, who was behind the use of force bill last year, and also House Public Safety Committee Chairman Roger Goodman. Goodman has, of course, been driving this bus since we got I-940 to the ballot. He is the person who can get both sides, all sides, kind of in the same room to discuss and get to that actual fix. I know it's a top priority for him. And in fact, the first hearings on three of these police reform bills are going to be tomorrow in his House Public Safety Committee. So mm-hmm. they're top on the agenda for sure. But what you're saying is exactly what Republican Minority Leader in the Senate, John Braun, said is, look, I don't care if we repeal them or reform whatever. We just need to do something.
We've been very clear. We're supportive of reasonable reform to law enforcement. We just don't want to take away the tools, the tactics, put them in a situation where they cannot keep our community safe. And in particular, I'm very concerned about their impact on the ability to cooperate and with the mental health services around our state. This is a big deal where I live, where historically our law enforcement has worked very well with mental health providers to keep them and their clients safe. And this is not working. So whether it's a repeal or reform, the reform bills, I'm sort of indifferent. What I don't want to do is kind of put some window dressing on it, say we fixed it, and then walk away and leave our communities unsafe for another year.
So all sides want to get something done, and it sounds like that will happen quickly. The other one that is, of course, a top priority is the long-term care, which we talked about last week as well. This preview session on Friday that happened after our show got a little bit more insight as to what is going to happen with the long-term care, whether, you know, what it's going to be a straight repeal or a reform, as we've been talking about with the police bills. Lori Jenkins says she backs the implementation, the delay bill, which is from Pat Sullivan, to delay the implementation of this bill until the middle of 2023. She was also asked about the fact that 450,000 people in Washington state have applied to opt out of this and whether that would drive up the cost of any of this program.
A pretty high number of opt-outs. One of the things I'm pleased about is I went back and looked last night. The original modeling for the program actually assumed this level of opting out. And that's what the premium was based on. So I don't think we will be in a difficult position in that regard. But this will provide some time for the actuaries to look at that and see if there's anything that we need to alter or do in order to address that issue.
Like the policing bills, there are some handful of fixes that they're going to look at with legislation to help those who live out of state and work in the state who are paying into the tax, but as it's currently written, wouldn't be able to access that money ever, and a few other things that we've heard from the insurance industry. Republicans, though, they're not they say that is not going to be enough. Republican John Braun wants it gone altogether.
We can delay it. I'm certainly not going to oppose delaying it, but I think we'd be better off repealing it, starting over, working on the problem from scratch, and really including everyone in the conversation instead of pushing this across as a partisan solution. Include everyone. You can get a better balance, better solution that fits everyone around the state.
And kind of a speed round, because I know time is short, I'll let you know what else that they weighed in on. On emergency powers, there's an appetite to hear some legislation, whether it would pass, I don't know, that would give the legislature a little bit more oversight. Right now, we're 700 some odd days into the governor kind of, and the perception is that he's kind of ruling on his own. Now, the leaders in all four, the House and Senate chambers have to sign off on much of what he does, but not all of it. So there's talk of, you know, having it go to the legislative leaders and having them at least be able to sign off on all of it. We'll see what that turns out to be, but there was somewhat of an appetite for that. Also on zoning, the bill that we talked about last week, the making the state in control of where you can build your duplexes, triplexes, etc. There's not as much of an appetite among any of the lawmakers, the four leaders that I was in a session with last week, to turn this over to the state. It's they really believe in local control. Yeah. They are finding a balance at least between the two things. So it doesn't sound as written. The Mona Das bill has a huge amount of support.
Okay, I was want to ask about one more thing.
Sure.
Nothing to do with legislature.
Okay.
But do you know anything about the governor's trip to Chicago and the feeling apparently among some Republicans that he is busily raising money possibly for another presidential run?
Rumor, but I wouldn't count that possibility out. That's what I can tell you about that.
Okay. So it's just rumor status at this point.
Yes, that as far as I know, as far as my insight tells me,
right.
Yes.
Well, I don't like to spread rumors, so I take it back.
Yes, okay.
Thank you, Anna.
You betcha.
All right. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.